Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest NPR PBS Marist poll that finds 54% of Americans think Trump's dealings with Russia were unethical or illegal, while 73% of Republicans believe Trump did nothing wrong, with only 4% saying he has done something illegal. The author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, and The Great Questions of Tomorrow, David Rothkopf, a columnist for The Washington Post and a visiting professor at Columbia University and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us. We will discuss Donald Trump's unprecedented attacks on American political leaders and institutions on foreign soil as he stood next to Poland's authoritarian leader, who was cracking down on his press and was no doubt pleased to hear Trump's attacks on the American press, along with his trashing of Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the U.S. intelligence community. Then we will speak with Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Generation, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. He joins us to discuss the extent to which Trump has laid the groundwork with his supporters by convincing them that the press propagates fake news, so that when the real news about Trump's ties to Putin comes out, 35% of Americans won't believe it. Then finally, we will look into the stark division in U.S. foreign policy between the Trump family and his coterie of right-wing fringe ideologues and the broader U.S. defense, intelligence, and diplomatic community, otherwise known as the Deep State, that have been laid bare by Saudi Arabia's attack on Qatar. David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, joins us from the UK to discuss the contentious report on the Saudi role in radicalizing young Muslims in Britain and how Trump and his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared's financial ties to the Saudi crown prince are dictating a dangerous Middle East policy that goes against U.S. interests in the region. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is a visiting professor at Columbia University and a columnist at The Washington Post and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and is the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. His latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Pleasure to be here.
And what do you make of this new poll that comes out from NPR, PBS, and Marist that finds 54% of Americans believe that Trump's dealing with Russia were unethical or illegal, but 73% of Republicans don't think so, and only 4% of them think he's done anything illegal. So it shows you that Trump has been successful in dividing this country into these kind of silos where his people believe that the mainstream media prints fake news and that he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his promises. So, I mean, and here he is in Poland, in Warsaw, trashing the mainstream press, trashing Hillary Clinton, trashing Obama, and trashing the intelligence community on foreign soil. It's extraordinary.
Well, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinarily sad for the United States, but I think we need to keep it in perspective. 70% of the Republican Party is only about 35% of the American people. I think that what we're seeing again and again and again is that there is a group, something like 30-35% of the American people, that will support Trump and will support him in, under any circumstances. I'm sure they feel that they are a kind of resistance to the, you know, the establishment. But of course, some of them are just members of the establishment who see Trump as someone who's likely to feather their nest. And the rest of them are what I would call a kind of permanent information underclass in America, a group of people that rely only on information sources that conform with their opinions. And people who are skeptical of anything that challenges their opinions, regardless of how underpinned it is in fact. And with regard to the Russia thing, which the president, again, in Warsaw today, equivocated on and suggested it might not have been Russia, might not have just been Russia, people don't know. The reality is that the facts are squarely against the president and squarely against the people in Nepal who don't think anything happened there. The Russians did this. Every intelligence agency in the United States government knows it. They have massive amounts of evidence to support it. It's not really at this point a disputable fact. Nobody credible disputes this fact. Whether there's something criminal that the Trump team did or not remains to be seen. But that the Russians hacked, it's almost as though, you know, Trump is the only senior person on the U.S. scene who disputes the facts of that hack.
So since you've been such a longtime student of U.S. foreign policy and have obviously had interactions with all of the architects of American power, as you wrote about in the National Security book about the National Security Council, and have had access to some of the people who've guided U.S. foreign policy over the years, if not decades, this has got to be the most extraordinary change. I mean, for example, Trump didn't meet with the Polish opposition. That's just a given. And you've got Donald Tusk, who's the head of the European Union, who's effectively the head of the Polish opposition. Who's in charge here? What about this reliance we have on the adults in the room, Generals Mattis and General McMaster? They don't seem to be able to stop Trump from doing stuff that's just not unusual, but is insulting and destructive.
Well, they don't, and the reality is the people that think that they do are increasingly being shown up. We saw it again today. President Trump delivers a speech that was written for him. The speech is, you know, stronger than what he kind of thing he normally says off the cuff. People give him high marks for acknowledging things that every American president has acknowledged for 75 years because Trump has failed so often to do that. And then he does a press conference, and during the press conference, he does a number of things off the cuff because he is ill-prepared and inexperienced and doesn't seem to care about that are just shocking. You know, he attacks his predecessor. He attacks the free press. Not only does he attack the free press and talk this fake news talk again, but he does it standing next to a Polish president who is currently in the midst of suppressing his own press and denying his own press access to the legislature. So he sends a message. He stands next to an enemy of a free press, and he says, hey, you know, I'm sort of alongside with you. He calls into question whether the Russians did this hack. He even, you know, says, well, you know, everybody says that 17 agencies of the U.S. intelligence community backed this report. Do we even have 17 agencies? Well, you know, all it takes is a Google search to discover that we have 17 agencies. Any intern in the United States government who wants to work in the security area can Google it and know that we have 17 intelligence agencies. And the president of the United States jokes as if we don't. It's appalling. And, you know, it's produced consequences. Today, the EU and Japan announced the biggest trade deal in the world in the past 20 years between the EU and Japan, sending a very clear message that if the United States is opting out of the world leadership on trade, they will step up. And this is what is happening. Trump, through ignorance, as a result of planning, as a result of the extremism of some of his supporters, is embracing a policy that is dismantling at a record pace the role that America has had as a leader since the end of the Second World War. And, you know, I had a very interesting experience at the Aspen Ideas Festival last week where I asked General David Petraeus, who is a kind of a supporter of Trump foreign policy, if he thought the president was fit to serve. And he said to me, I think that's immaterial because, you know, of these adults around him. Now, first of all, when your supporters don't say, "You, of course he's fit to serve," instead say it's immaterial, that's pretty shocking. But I think, you know, it's kind of sad for Petraeus to rely on the Mattis and McMasters of this world to influence Trump when there's so much evidence that they don't. Trump on Friday is going to meet with Vladimir Putin with Rex Tillerson and a translator. He's not even bringing his national security advisor, McMaster, into the meeting. Why?
Let alone Fiona Hill.
let alone his Russia expert.
Right.
And Lord knows, you know, Trump hasn't been sitting there poring over histories of Russia, right? He gets his briefings in the form of little tweet-length talking points, which he typically sets aside. So, you know, this is just a setup. Mm-hmm. You know, Putin, an experienced old hand, is the wolf entering the room, you know, and Trump is the roast goose on a platter. And Putin will get what he wants out of this meeting, and Trump's, you know, going to once again damage American interests through his own sort of narcissism and failure to recognize his own self-limitations.
Well, clearly in business, maybe his tactics of keeping everybody off balance worked, you know, maybe in these Manhattan real estate deals. But my sense is that obviously, keeping people off balance may be a polite way of saying he doesn't know what the hell's going on. But let's assume that there's a tactic behind this chaos. Isn't that the worst possible thing that you can practice in global leadership and foreign policy? I always understood that foreign policy depended upon consistency and reliability and commitment.
And not to mention expertise and having a set of goals and working with your allies and working with your own assets within the United States government. He doesn't do any of those things. I think we need to sort of wake up to the fact that Donald Trump was not a successful businessman. He did not run a big public company. He ran a family business. And that's very different because you're not answerable to anybody. And secondly, he ran it in a way where he regularly encountered failure and bankruptcy and where he didn't really make anything. What Donald Trump was his whole life was a guy who did branding, sold the Trump brand. And when you're selling a brand, when what you're doing is essentially promoting your name, all press is good press. And you know, Donald Trump is essentially the pre-Kardashian Kardashian. You know, he was out there, you know, at Studio 54 or getting married again or doing whatever he was doing, and he built some buzz. And he got elected that way because he managed to build more buzz than the other candidates around him. None of that is translatable to being president of the United States. It doesn't help our interests. Bad press for us is actually bad for our interests. It doesn't help him govern. He has no real experience running a big complex organization. And his propensity for delegating, because he doesn't actually have any interest in substance, is undermined by the desire of him and some of his supporters not to actually populate the key positions in the government to which one might delegate, the undersecretaries and deputy secretaries and so forth. So 550 out of 600 positions in the United States government that are supposed to be filled by presidential appointees have yet to be filled by them, not because the positions have been blocked by the Democrats, but because the Republicans haven't put anybody up. The guy's a disaster. And as I wrote this week in the Washington Post, I think that the single biggest security threat to the United States of America is the president of the United States of America, because he's erratic, ill-suited to the job, undercutting our leadership, undermining our interests, and playing into the hands of our enemies.
Well, I guess the lesson here is that elections have consequences and that people should realize that the president has enormous powers. And in spite of this man's reckless incompetence, it does seem that he's able to almost treat the White House as an acquisition. He's continues to make money. It seems that most of his foreign policy decisions are based upon flattery and who likes him. The Polish guy promised him adoring crowds. The dictator in Turkey has business dealings, at least his cronies do, with Trump, as is the case in Manila. That's why he's been nice to that murderous leader in the Philippines. And my understanding is that MBS, the boy king in Saudi Arabia, has forged a friendship with Jared Kushner. And already Ivanka Trump has gotten $100 million for her foundation. And there's some rumors that Trump's working on with the Saudis to fund his re-election. So this is what I find extraordinary. How come, you know, we can't lay a glove on this guy when he's so brazenly corrupt?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say we can't lay a glove on this guy. The reality is we just haven't done it yet. We're 6 months into this thing. I mean, 3 weeks into the thing, his national security advisor had to resign. His national security advisor is now facing the choice of going to jail or flipping on the president. No wonder the president of the United States is being nice to this guy 4.5 months after firing him. But, you now have a special prosecutor at the earliest point that you ever had one in an administration. There are a special, counsel looking into this thing. You've got multiple committees on the Hill looking into this thing. Some of them are going to dig deeper. Something will be found. And I think, there's quite a good possibility the president of the United States is going to be called out on this. But I think your bigger point gets to a different lesson altogether, and that is 35% of the American people are living in an information bubble, eating the garbage that is fed to them by Fox News, believing what they want to believe, and there is nothing that a Democratic candidate or Republican candidate or occupant of higher office is going to do to change their minds, which means that anytime we have an election, they're a given. They're going in a certain direction. And so you have to go and look at the remaining 30% or 40% of the Republican Party and the center and the Democratic Party to determine who's actually going to win the next election. Because there is a group here that is immune to facts, that is allergic to facts. We're not going to reason with them. We are not going to persuade them, because what they believe is complete nonsense, that even a cursory look at the daily newspaper or a cursory amount of research would prove to be untrue. They're just unwilling to make that effort.
But you're still talking about an opposition of 65%. That's a solid majority. I don't see a particular narrative coming from the Democrats. There's so many Democrats that I speak to on the liberal progressive side who are completely invested in Trump being impeached, but they don't have an alternative reality. We saw what happened down in Georgia with the guy that didn't even live in the district, whose campaign platform was "let's be nice to each other." Isn't there a deficit in terms of, I mean, Trump, we know he got $5 billion worth of free advertising. We know how he's a train wreck that, the press are attracted to the bright shining light of chaos. But in the meantime, don't we need a little bit of dignity, a little bit of sobriety, and a real alternative message?
Of course we do. And I don't think the Democratic Party or the Republican Party has focused much on what's the message for tomorrow in a long time. They focused on obstruction, or they focused on the past, or they focused on character assassination. They've made everything personal. They've made it petty, and they've focused on the short term. And of course, as a country on the verge of major technological changes, major demographic changes, major cultural changes in the makeup of our society, major changes in the way that our economy works, that jobs are created, that wealth is created, we need people who have an agenda for the future. We should look around the world and say, are there examples of situations like ours? And I think one that we might look at is France, where both political parties became so distrusted that a candidate emerged without any relationship to the established political parties, but who offered something that seemed like a credible alternative in Emmanuel Macron. And he actually won. A centrist candidate, but one who is 39 years old, somebody who has a kind of outsider image, but who'd also been the finance minister and understood how the government worked, who had an agenda that took into consideration the needs of the people of France and the future of the economy, and it worked. And I think we need to look at other examples of people who are coming along who've got compelling agendas, whether it's, outside of the country, people like Justin Trudeau or in Canada, or inside the country, mayors or others who are solving problems on a daily basis. But there is no question that, the leadership of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is intellectually bankrupt and has suffered failures of creativity that in any other business would have had them pink slipped and out the door in no time. I think this is the crisis of America. It's not Trump, who's a symptom of the crisis. We've elected a boob to be president of the United States, and we're paying the price for it. But even 6 months into that, I can't tell you who the leader of the opposition is in the Democratic Party. I can't tell you where the next big idea is. I can't tell you who's sitting there saying, this is how we're going to create jobs, and this is how we're going to reduce inequality, and this is how we're going to fix our infrastructure, and this is how we're going to create a healthcare or education system for the 21st century. I know those issues need to be addressed, and I bet if you and I got together in a room, we could make a list of people who might solve the problem. But that isn't happening in the Democratic Party. It's not happening in the Republican Party. And if that's the case, and Trump does get called to task and he does get thrown out of office, you're going to end up with Mike Pence, who is actually ideological, knows some stuff, and in some respects is even more dangerous than Trump. And again, will play to this base of know-nothings who are supporting Trump. So we've got a crisis, and the crisis isn't the current leader. The crisis is who's the next leader.
Well, David Rothkopf, you've given us a lot to think about, and I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's a columnist at the Washington Post and a visiting professor at Columbia University and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. His latest book is The Great Questions of Tomorrow. We're going to take a brief station break back, looking into how Trump has laid the groundwork with his supporters, convincing them that the press propagates fake news, so that when the real news about Trump ties to Putin comes out, 35% of Americans won't believe it.
Come, you masters of war, ye that build the big guns, ye that build the death planes, ye that build all the bombs, ye that hide behind walls, ye that hide behind disks, I just don't want you.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Timothy McCarthy, a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. An award-winning scholar, teacher, and public servant, he is the author of Protest Nations, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and The Indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy McCarthy.
Welcome, Ian. It's great to see you again.
Thank you for joining us, Tim. And there's a very extraordinary poll that's just come out from NPR PBS that finds that the majority of Republicans do not believe that there is anything to this Russia story in terms of interfering in our elections and the possibility of collusion with the Trump campaign. And it would indicate to me that Trump has been successful in creating this idea that the mainstream press propagates fake news and that his supporters should only listen to him. And we know that his ratings are very high amongst Republicans. So how do you see it?
Well, I think we're living in multiple alternative universes right now, Ian, frankly, in the United States. And so, you know, on the one hand, you have an entire kind of right-wing media and now political infrastructure that is devoted to disrupting and challenging our sense of reality by propagating fake news stories, by reframing things, you know, from everything from the number of people who attended Trump's inauguration versus Obama's to, you know, whether or not there are child sex slave colonies on Mars that NASA had to spend some time refuting this week. You know, we have an entire kind of infrastructure that's swirling around the president, and that certainly has helped to get him there, not only because he surrounded himself by some of the folks who are responsible for creating this infrastructure, but also because of the ranks of his base who you know, regularly kind of ingest and digest these kinds of stories. On the other hand, you have, coming from the White House, a whole set of challenges to the mainstream media, to the New York Times, to CNN, to the Washington Post, to some of our most respected journalistic outlets. And that kind of constant sort of questioning of the lamestream media, the fake news of CNN, the sort of integrity of these, you know, really wonderful news and media outlets, has the sense of always kind of raising in our minds, like, is this true? Is what they're saying true, et cetera? And people who are more likely to support the president, who are Republicans and people who voted for him, are more likely to kind of question the mainstream media at the same time that they're ingesting and digesting and circulating the fake news that's coming from the infrastructure that was created to perpetuate this disruption. So we're in a very dangerous territory here. I just also read an article earlier this morning that the left is doing its own version of this, that 20% of the news that's posted on Facebook pages and websites like Occupy Democrats and the other 98% and so forth are themselves fake news items. And so the left is fighting the right and sort of taking a page out of their handbook and reproducing its own stuff that only generates paranoia and conspiracy thinking within the ranks of the left that we see happening in the ranks of the right. And so we're living in alternative universes, and we're living in a deeply polarized political climate that is being further fostered by not only the media infrastructures that are giving us our news or not news, but also the political establishments that are benefiting from this or trying to fight what is currently in power.
And, of course, the left is so deeply invested in Trump's impeachment, it's somehow prevented them from actually coming up with a narrative of what they do better. I mean, they had every reason to win the last election, at least at the presidential level, but they didn't have a message. And as far as I could tell, they still don't have a message.
Well, I think that it makes sense. I don't disagree with you, but I think it's important for us to make distinctions between the left, right, which is now sort of dubbing itself the resistance, the kind of social movement, grassroots organizing that happens outside of mainstream politics, and the Democratic Party, which is the sort of left of our two-party system, but hardly left in a sense of, you know, deeply progressive and redistributive kinds of policies. So I think it's important to make that distinction. I actually think that the left, Black Lives Matter, the Occupy movement, initially the Women's March, the various organizations that are working on behalf of undocumented people, indigenous land rights, etc., I think actually are those kinds of organizations and movement cultures, I think, do have a message about the redistribution of resources, about the fact that our political and economic systems have failed us and are failing us, an agenda around opportunity, around equality, around dignity, around the rights of citizenship, these kinds of things. I think there is, on the left, an emerging narrative and an emerging articulation of progressive values that I think is a winning one, because we know from other polls that, you know, the majority of Americans believe in opportunity for all, believe in the right to people to be taken care of in terms of health care, in terms of access to education, in terms of being able to aspire to a better life. We know that the most progressive kinds of public policy that we've seen in the United States that help to reach as many people as possible, that can lift as many boats as possible, over time are incredibly popular. And so there is a progressive agenda in terms of policy and in terms of the articulation of values that I think is a winning one. Whether the Democratic Party has been able to get on board with that or have the courage to articulate that is a whole other set of questions. And I totally agree with you that within our two-party system, the Democrats have failed and are failing to articulate a values-based progressive agenda that would reach not just rhetorically the vast majority of the population of the United States, but also in terms of policy attractiveness those people as well. And so I think we're in a really a difficult time for the Democrats right now, and they just have to get their stuff together because they're in a bad place right now.
So just to touch on the NPR-PBS Marist poll that came out, 54% of the American people believe that Trump has done something untoward, if not unethical, vis-a-vis the Russians. Specifically, the 41% of Democrats believe Trump himself has done something illegal, 39% say he has done something unethical but not illegal, and 13% think he has done nothing wrong. And on the Republican side, you've got 73% of Republicans say Trump himself has done nothing wrong, with 15% saying he's done something unethical but not illegal, and just 4% say he's done something illegal. Now, in Poland, at a press conference in Warsaw on Thursday, Donald Trump was asked why he keeps shying away from castigating the Kremlin for hacking the elections, and Trump says, I think it was Russia, but I think it was probably other people or countries. I see nothing wrong with the statement, he added. Nobody really knows. Nobody really knows for sure. So here he is, the man that gets all of the intelligence briefings. I believe he doesn't really even take the daily briefing. But still, I find it extraordinary that on foreign soil, the president of the United States essentially trashes his own government departments, particularly the national security intelligence community.
Yeah, the Warsaw press conference was an astonishing moment, a terrifying one, frankly, given the instability that Donald Trump's presidency has caused, not just within the United States, but globally. Not only did he call into question, and as you say, trash the intelligence community and the intelligence agencies, he also implicitly and explicitly attacked the political committees that are investigating or they're participating in the investigation of potential collusion or potential unethical or illegal behavior. He also trashed the media again, and then also went after both Barack Obama, his predecessor, former president of the United States, and his opponent, Hillary Clinton, taking an additional swipe at them on foreign soil. And so this is a man who's, I say it over and over again, I mean, Donald Trump is a wrecking ball. And we have to be very careful of that. He doesn't have an ideology per se. He certainly has no values that root the work that he does. But his kind of narcissism and his temperamental, volatility is very dangerous, particularly in a world where North Korea is successfully testing nuclear potential missiles with nuclear capability that can reach Alaska, where Trump's attacks on NATO have destabilized that infrastructure. Where he's basically alienated every head of state that he's come in contact with, who's not a dictator or some kind of authoritarian nightmare like himself. And so I think we're in a dangerous place. And I think that but this gets back to the question about the fake news, that Donald Trump and his people are trying to destabilize and call into question the legitimacy of every institution that exists in American culture and global culture, frankly, but certainly within the United States, this is part of their agenda. And what this does then is, by constantly talking about fake news and the lamestream media and all of this, it means that when the news is finally reported about whatever has been done in Russia, whatever collusion has taken place or not, whatever unethical behavior has transpired or not, whatever illegal behavior has transpired or not, if those investigations lead to a kind of damning indictment, literally or figuratively, of the president and his people, then all of this disruption and denouncing and questioning of the media will then raise questions in the heads of his people, and particularly and of people more broadly, about the legitimacy of those reports, the legitimacy of those investigations. So what he's doing is he's laying the groundwork by calling into question or raising suspicions about the investigations, the intelligence community, the congressional hearings, the media coverage itself, all of this, the Democrats' over-reliance on Russia as the kind of smoking gun of his that will undo his presidency. He's doing a masterful job of this, and we're playing along, right? I think we have to be very clear about what they're doing. Every time there's a White House press briefing, every time he gets up and says what he did in a place like Warsaw, every time there's an attack on the mainstream media or on Congress or on these investigative committees or the intelligence community, what Donald Trump and his people are doing are laying the groundwork for us to hold in a light of suspicion the findings that will ultimately come. And so I found it, again, I was flabbergasted at his behavior and what he was saying from the podium in Warsaw yesterday, but not surprised, because this is how he operates and this is how they operate. And it's very, very troubling if we care about institutions in the United States.
So can you make the Orwellian analogy? When was the last time we had a government? Certainly, in the United States. I don't think there's ever been a government like this in terms of using the Joseph Goebbels and Stalin's tactics. We've seen it around the world, but is there anything like it in our history?
Well, you know, I am not one of these folks who, you know, who longs for the days of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and John Ashcroft. I mean, there are a lot of people, a lot of Democrats and a lot of, you know, even people on the liberal left who are saying, oh, my God, you know, what I wouldn't do to have Bush back. You know, I mean, we saw this with them, right? I mean, Congress, you know, passed a bill to rename French fries Freedom Fries after 9/11. The Patriot Act was a deeply, I mean, talk about Orwellian, right? The axis of evil, the language that was used, weapons of mass destruction, Colin Powell going to the United Nations and, you know, showing the vials and the aerial views of the camps where these weapons of mass destruction were supposedly held. The fact that when Colin Powell did a press conference after his appearance in January of 2003, before the United Nations, they covered up the White House and the press the White House advance team covered up, obscured the Picasso reproduction of the Picasso painting Guernica, so they could have a press conference in front of that after they drummed up and literally invented, constructed a fictional account or justification for going to war. So we've seen this before in my lifetime. I mean, I you know, those of us who were very outspoken against the Bush administration's rush to war in Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11 were subjected to all sorts of Orwellian kinds of practices. Right. And you know, I certainly don't think that there hasn't been this kind of full frontal assault on the media and on institutions and so forth, but there was certainly a good deal of Orwellian behavior going on in the Bush administration, particularly with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and John Ashcroft and others in charge, the way that they would justify torture, you know, enhanced interrogation techniques. I mean, that's Orwellian. I mean, Orwell couldn't have imagined that more profoundly. So I do think we've seen this before. You know, all presidents on some level manipulate the media and manipulate the press and therefore manipulate the people. So this is not the first time, certainly, that we've seen this. I think it's the most aggressive and overt. And because we live in a world where we ourselves, as citizens on social media, are also the producers and not just the consumers, the creators and not just the consumers of social media and of news and content, that I think it's easier for us to sort of push back on that and to expose it for what it is. But it's also easier, as we've seen in the right-wing fake news machine, we've seen that we create our own fake news. We create our own obfuscations and our own narratives and our own conspiracy theories that are not helping us see clearly in this political moment.
Yeah, I guess I was trying to make a distinction between how White Houses have always manipulated the press or tried to use it, but it's another thing to actually create your own alternative press and your own alternative reality. But just to touch on Trump's campaign, the extent to which it was all about draining the swamp, and he was a populist who's ending up ruling as a plutocrat. And what happened in between? And one of the theories is that, to give Trump the benefit of the doubt, he's abandoned the populist stance on draining the swamp and getting rid of the money-based, corrupt Washington system. Of course, he was the outsider and was able to say everybody else is a part of this corrupt system, all of which is true. But what's happened since? So do you think that he has become a captive of the Congress, particularly of Paul Ryan and company, because he needs them to prevent the impeachment? In other words, is the Russian investigation basically driving him into the hands of Paul Ryan and the kind of Koch brothers owned and operated Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some of that happening. There's no question about this. But I mean, I'm not willing to give. I'm not willing to be generous to Donald Trump. He's not generous to any of us. So you know, why model that behavior for him? Donald Trump had no intention of draining the swamp. Donald Trump had no intention of casting corruption out of the Capitol, right? That he talked a big game and it sounded good. He had no intention of bringing back coal jobs. He had no intention of doing anything that he said he was going to do. What he did was he ran a campaign that was based on that exploited the innate fears and loathings and anxieties and angers of the American population at this particular moment in the decline of our democracy and the widening gaps between the haves and the have-nots. And he did that brilliantly because he's a brilliant media manipulator. He's someone who has been doing this his entire life. You know, I grew up in New York. So, I mean, I've been reading about Donald Trump in the pages of the New York Post and the Daily News, not the New York Times, since I was in middle school. And, you know, so Donald Trump is known to those of us who have grown up with him as a carnival barker, as a narcissist, as a sexist, as a racist, as an exploiter of people, as a, you know, greedy capitalist. I mean, all of these things. I mean, I've known these things since I was too young to vote. And so, you know, America is now being introduced to what we've always known. And so, you know, he's not someone who, you know, I mean, the New York Times has done, you know, the fake news New York Times, of course, has done some really good reporting about all the lies he's told since he became president. He tells lies every day. And so, I mean, if he were Pinocchio, his nose would, you know, reach North Korea at this point. And so he is someone who trades in lies, and he performs these sort of truths, which are not really truths. And then he disrupts our sense of reality. And so all the while, sort of, you know, forging his celebrity, his national and global celebrity, through reality television, which is deeply ironic. I mean, there are so many layers of this that are just contribute to the crazy. But this is a man who had no intention of doing anything that he said he was going to do. So it doesn't surprise me that he has not invested himself fully in the art of governing or the art of lawmaking or the sausage making that goes in and the kind of whipping that needs to happen to get votes and so forth, that he's leaving that up to Congress. Whether or not he, in his sort of heart of hearts, understands that this Russia thing is actually going to bring him down, or it's going to be the thing that might bring him down, then, yeah, sure, he doesn't want to play too much hardball with Congress, because those are the folks who are going to ultimately, you know, determine his fate one way or the other. And so I think there is some truth to that. I also think there's some truth to the fact that certainly the Koch brothers have an outsized influence, financially and otherwise, on Republican politics. That's been true for some time now, and they're not the only one. Sheldon Adelson and others have outsized influence too. But the fact of the matter is that right now, I think the Republicans and the Republican majorities in both houses of Congress themselves have become victims of this wrecking ball. I mean, just, you need to look no further than the health care debate or the debate over the health care bill. I would argue that Donald Trump doesn't care. This is merely a rhetorical performance that helped get him elected, that he is never going to deliver on, and is hardly the only policy position where that is true.
Well, Timothy McCarthy, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Ian. Great to be with you, as always.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Timothy McCarthy, who's a lecturer on history, literature, and public policy, and director of the Sexuality, Gender, and Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, an award-winning scholar, teacher, and public servant. He's the author of Protest Nation, Words That Inspired a Century of American Radicalism, and the indispensable Zin, The Essential Writings of the People's Historian. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the stark divisions in U.S. foreign policy between the Trump family and the so-called deep state.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from the UK is David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, who formerly was the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, a former associate foreign editor and European editor, Moscow bureau chief and European correspondent. His latest article at Middle East Eye is The End of One Revolution and the Start of Another. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Hurst.
Hello, hi.
So what is happening there in the UK in terms of this political contention going on over pressure being put on Theresa May? It's been going on since actually the Manchester bombing to release a study that when she was head of the Home Office apparently was done that finds, from at least from leaks, says that there's a clear link between Saudi Arabia and UK extremism, that Saudi Arabia has been the chief foreign promoter of Islamic extremism in the UK. And of course, the report comes from the Henry Jackson Society, named after Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, who arguably was the godfather of the American neocon movement. So to that extent, one has to question this report. But it has become a political hot potato, has it not?
Well, yes, it has. I mean, there are several things going on here, and one just has to sort of untangle them. Firstly, Henry Jackson, as a organization, as a supporter of Israel, not just Israel, but the most extreme elements in it, have an agenda in identifying Muslim groups, particularly Islamist Muslim groups, as extremist. And they're using Saudi Arabia to do this. If you look at the report itself, it relies very, very heavily on press cuttings and Channel 4 documentaries. It doesn't actually uncover any, make any original research, but it, and we have to sup from a long spoon with the Henry Jackson Society, because even the police now, the Middle East Eye reported earlier this month that the Met deputy chief, the deputy chief of the Metropolitan Police in London, Mark Rowley, missed the launch of a previous report by the think tank amid accusations it was demonizing Muslims. So they've got an agenda here, and it's basically to target all Muslim organizations and demonize them. And also their definition of what is Islamist, what is extremist. They include the Muslim Brotherhood in this. As you know, Saudi Arabia is basically conducting a worldwide campaign against the Muslim Brotherhood, and certainly the Emirates are as well. So all of this gets very, very tangled up and mashed up when it applies to Britain and British Muslims. The other problem that you need to sort of untangle is Theresa May's problem. She was Home Secretary at the time of the Prevent program, and there are a number of failings going on, particularly counterintelligence and security failings, which have been revealed from the spate of bombings and attacks and that Britain has endured over the last few months. And there's one particular problem that May has, and it's almost it's a legal one, is how you define nonviolent extremism. It's extremely difficult to do that without bringing in a whole bunch of other groups, animal rights activists, a whole bunch of groups who could be framed as nonviolent extremists. So there's several things going on here, and there isn't any real clear policy emerging from this. The third thing that's going on is the wish of successive British governments to protect Saudi Arabia. And they do this because basically we are selling them more, the Saudi Royal Air Force, more planes than our own Royal Air Force is buying. Quite simply, the British economy could not stand the loss of Saudi Arabia as a Well, certainly the aircraft industry couldn't stand the loss of Saudi Arabia as a client. So there's been a perennial desire, not just by May, but by Tony Blair, who stifled a serious fraud squad inquiry into the sale of jets to Saudi Arabia. For over 10 years, 15 years, there's been a campaign to suppress any examination
of Saudi Arabia and Britain's very, very murky relationship with it.
So now, but one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, David, is that the rank hypocrisy of Saudi Arabia accusing Qatar of being the source of all radicalism in the Middle East, when in fact their history is extraordinary, you know, going back to 9/11 and the Wahhabi influence throughout all these mosques from which many of these European terrorists, or those who have conducted terrorist acts in Europe, were radicalized, and of course prison, or Prislam as it's often referred to, and now you have Indonesia, which has always been a fairly moderate country. The Wahhabi influence there has resulted in a Christian governor being deposed. So they're having an influence around the world, but at the same time, this the sort of boy king, MBS, seems to have bitten off more than he can chew in Yemen, and the Qataris could have called his bluff on this, these 13 points demand, the deadline passed. So what do you think's happening there? Because my take on it is that both Sisi and the Saudis essentially want to shut down Al Jazeera. In a way, there's an element of spite where they want to pay back the Arab street for their Arab Spring, basically saying to the street, you know, you've had your fun now, let's get back to reality. And
I really do agree with your assessment. It's one I share. I mean, on the first part of the question, there is rank hypocrisy, and it's a very dodgy tactic to accuse a neighbor of funding extremist groups, Nusra, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, when you've done exactly the same thing yourself. And so all it's done is put the spotlight on a few dark incidents. There's a 9/11, that's one. Another one is the release of nearly 1,300 inmates on death row, including rapists and murderers. That was done by Prince Bandar bin Sultan on condition that they go to jihad in Syria. There's a Saudi Interior Ministry document dated the 7th of April 2012, and it's up on the internet, and it's a completely genuine thing. So they released jihadis to go and fight in Syria against Assad. Assad, by the way, did the same thing from his own prisons to weaponize and militarize what was originally a peaceful revolution against him. There are other instances of rank hypocrisy. Our website, Middle East Eye, published UN documents dated from the 3rd of February this year, in which it's very clearly stated that Egypt, acting on Saudi's behalf, because it's part of the same alliance, placed a hold on a US proposal to add IS entities in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Libya, and Afghanistan, Pakistan, to a UN list of sanctioned groups and individuals. And they did the same thing again in May, and that was reported by the Washington Post. And the only explanation for that is that Saudi Arabia did not want to draw attention to its own problem with the Islamic State in its own territory. And obviously it has one. Every Arab country has one, particularly Saudi Arabia. There's a massive amount of hypocrisy. On the second part of the question, yes, I completely agree with you. What I think this is payback time for the Arab Spring. I mean, 4 years ago, there was a coup in Egypt, and I think that this is, not just this, but I think also the attempted coup in Turkey, which has Emirati fingerprints all over it in terms of funding and organization. Both of those events were basically trying to finish off the job, sort of counter-revolution that they started 4 years ago when they got rid of Morsi. I don't think it will work this time. I think Turkey's still around and brutally cracked down on the coup plotters in the aftermath and anyone else that they feel like cracking down on. But I don't think Qatar's going to roll over either. And particularly the placing of Al Jazeera on the top of the list of demands is a bit of a giveaway. Because Al Jazeera, whatever you think about it, is a really new thing for the Arab media. It's not an extension of the secret police, as most media organizations in the Arab world. It is much more of on a BBC, CNN-type model. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it has given the Arab world and the Arab street a voice. And this is exactly what the Saudis and the Emiratis don't want, because they basically don't want people, the millions of their own population, hearing stuff that they themselves are not in control of. It's a classic case of authoritarian, absolutist behavior. They don't want people looking at their own finances and how much the House of Saud, the royal family, spends. They don't want independent scrutiny on a whole range of subjects. And so this isn't just about Qatar. This is also about any media voice like Middle East Eye. Middle East Eye was also placed on this list of demands. I must say that we've got absolutely nothing to do with Qatar. We're not funded by Qatar, but we were placed on it. I think one of the reasons we were placed on the list alongside Al Jazeera was because I've written a series of articles which we have talked about in the past about the palace coup. I'm not boasting about it, but they turned out to be accurate as to what was going on. And when actually what I was describing happened, they blocked the website and put us on this list, demanding that Qatar close us down. Well, Qatar can't close us down because they've got nothing to do with us. But it's indicative of the mindset here, which is trying to basically push back the waves of independent scrutiny and modern journalism.
Well, just in the last minute, David Hurst, I understand that Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has forged a relationship with MBS, the boy king, Mohammed bin Salman. $100 million has already been given to Ivanka for her charities. There's some rumors that the Saudis may bankroll Trump's re-election.
Yeah, absolutely. This is how foreign policy is made in the States now. There's pushback against it because what's going on against Qatar is absolutely not being backed by the American deep state, if you like to call it that, the CIA and the Pentagon. They're furious. But Trump and his family and the sort of system of Russian-type oligarchs that you've now got in the States are doing their own thing, and they're creating mayhem. One of the features of this is that America is fighting with itself. It's got two foreign policies. One is a pro-Qatar one, if you want, or a prove that at least a policy that says, well, if there are allegations against Qatar, prove them. And the other one doesn't want proof at all. It just basically works on fake news. One's in the White House and the other is just down the road. And who wins is anyone's guess.
Well, David Hurst, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Hurst, who's in the UK. He's the editor of the Middle East Eye and was formerly the chief foreign leader writer of The Guardian, former associate foreign editor, European editor, Moscow bureau chief, and European correspondent for The Guardian. And his latest article at the Middle East Eye is The End of One Revolution and the Start of Another. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Pernard. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was